Over the last few years, a lot of real estate investors learned the hard way that a polished pitch deck and a big internal rate of return number don't equal safety. Deals went sideways, capital got trapped, and suddenly due diligence mattered more than ever. This is the Real Estate Investing for Cashflow podcast, where we talk with experienced operators, investors, and capital stewards about how to build durable, cash-flowing real estate portfolios through real-world discipline. Today's guest sits in a very unique seat. She doesn't just invest her own money, but she also allocates capital on behalf of others. And that changes how you look at risk. Sarah Muschelli is the founder of Highly Capital. She grew up working alongside her father and her family's portfolio in Canada and shares how that experience in real estate has provided a level of optionality for her and her family. We're going to kick off the conversation here today focused on intentionally designing a lifestyle supported by real estate, cash flow, and long-term stewardship. One of the coolest parts of your story is that you've been able to craft a life where, you split your time between Costa Rica, Costa Rica the majority of time, and Toronto. You're originally from Toronto, but moved with your family. You've got three children, a husband, and you guys packed up and moved from the, from the cold north down to Costa Rica and built a life there. And so you would love to know what key decisions that you made that ultimately made that lifestyle possible.
It's going to sound cheesy, but real estate. So, I grew up in real estate and, grew up in property management, helping my dad essentially, clean units before new tenants came in and, help him with the books. Like, he would always be putting me to work. And then I really understood asset management, like from a young age in multifamily. And then from there, I started getting into real estate sales. I was scaling up a business in Toronto, pretty successful. But then it was, I thought about kids and it was that kind of season of life. And I do not like winter. I feel like this classic, answer is just not fun for me personally. We really saw as the world changes, the opportunity to, move somewhere where we really did like the lifestyle. So I love surfing, surf a couple times a week. My kids, are outside all the time. And, it was really because I had assets that were producing cash flow. My husband as well started by buying, single families in Detroit. And those obviously over time he scaled up and that created cash flow. And then from there, just investing in LP deals and getting cash flow in different syndication offerings. So just creating multiple income streams and then also working in fund management as well, we're able to do that remotely. It all kind of came together to make this life possible, living in Costa Rica. So that's kind of the long and short of it.
Yeah, no, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, lifestyle by design, we were talking about a little bit before we start recording, just, a trip that my family and I are about to embark on where, we're going to leave our home base and go to a floating home base on a boat for about a year and travel the country and, very unique, but, out of your comfort zone. So there's excitement in our household, but there's surely trepidation, right? There's the unknown that exists out there. And it's interesting. So, kind of running my business, growing the business, trying to keep all the pieces of the puzzle in place, and maintain structure while kind of planning this adventure. It's been fun, but ultimately challenging. And I think one of the bigger challenges is just even getting the family sold on the idea. My family, like my wife and my boys, are super excited about it, but it wasn't just a function of having a conversation over dinner and they're like, yeah, let's do it. It took a lot of planting seeds and then a lot of planning in general, just like putting some framework in place in order to kind of kick off the journey. In fact, we haven't kicked it off yet. So the plan is over the next, within 6 weeks that we're going to, leave port and kind of roll on. But we'd love to know from you, like just those earlier stages of this planning, the idea. So we'd love to know or better understand from you what that looked like when you started planting the seeds, what those conversations look like, and really how you got the entire family pumped up and on board for essentially moving thousands upon thousands of miles away from your home base.
The mindset of being like, is this something that is possible for us? I think that's where it starts for anyone. And it's almost like when you're on the other side of that and you like live that life, you kind of forget that is a huge hurdle for a lot of people. And it once was, for me and, other people that I know. But it's like once you can be like, hey, this is possible, this is the goal, and I'm going to create the life and figure out the rest. That's where a lot of people who live in my town, like that's how it's worked for them. Everybody is from a different income bracket, from a different place, with different family structures. But they all made that decision of is this something that I'm going to commit to? And how am I going to, as you said, put the puzzle pieces together to make it work? Like this boat trip, like that is a lot of puzzle pieces, especially when you're running a company, but you're committed to the goal and the results of that. And I think that that's really the mindset shift. And for us, it was, you know, living in Canada, I think what, you know, I have to have gratitude for, you know, parents, like we had the immigrant parents who came from the other countries to a place like Canada, who worked so incredibly hard. Like I give so much kudos to my dad, coming with nothing, starting to get invested in real estate and, you know, working it as an electrician. But it's like that mindset to even come to a country like Canada as an immigrant. It's almost like there's this shift now that we've seen this possible through, you know, creating income streams or by working remotely, that we can now see that it's possible to really get that other piece, which is maybe that more lifestyle component that we want to enjoy our life now while also working very hard, which I know you do. So I think that to simplify it is just, you know, making that decision and knowing it's possible for you is probably the biggest piece.
Yeah. Was there any pushback from maybe not your immediate family, like your husband and your children, but
no,
I'm sure your in-laws, your parents?
I will say that this is the biggest thing I do hear is like my kids are young. I have a 7-month-old, a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old.
Oh,
so
wow. Okay.
They didn't have much say. Yeah, they didn't have to say, but it's also like that is a challenge. I do hear from people that whose children are older that they have a more set group of friends. They have a more set routine. It's almost like a little bit of my motivation was like getting my kids out before they knew something different. So I do once again feel pretty like lucky in that sense. But I think if you do have children that are a little bit older, then yes, that's a challenge. But as I was mentioning before, I think the biggest challenge for us now is like we love our family and having our in-laws in a different place now is challenging. But that's how we go back to Toronto. But then it comes down to like, you know, we want to design a life where, you know, we can kind of have it all. And it doesn't always look perfect, believe me. But that is really the objective here.
Yeah. No, so I'm going to share a little gold nugget with everyone that's tuning here. In the event you've got some, you know, grandeur dreams, you would like to do maybe something similar to that of Sarah or myself, or just maybe have your own version of that, right? And kind of, you know, buck the norm. But you've got children, you're worried about, you know, number one, you know, our concern in our household was taking them out of school, or taking away, more importantly, not just school per se. They're very studious and they're very resourceful. They'll do fine if they just, you know, with the homeschool thing, but it was more so taken away from their friends, right? Like they're 9 and 12. And so they're in sports and the 9-year-old, he could probably care less. But I thought the 12-year-old would have, Jackson, my oldest one, would have, you know, major concerns about really separating him from his, he's got some close buddies now that he's, you know, grown up with here in the neighborhood. And so, but the sales pitch that I gave them, while they do great in school and they enjoy their friends in school and they enjoy going there and just, you know, hanging out with their buds and all that, they could do away with the school itself part, like the physical part. I did know that. And so I gave them the sales pitch. I said, hey, you guys go 5 days a week to school. And realistically, if you really think about it, if you distilled it down, you're probably spending about 2 to 3 hours in any given day at school where you're actually doing work. And so what if I told you there was a way that you could do an entire week's worth of school at your own pace, but that pace being much more, much faster than that of what the traditional pace is. You could get it done in 2 days and have a 5-day weekend. And that was my sales pitch to them, and they were sold. They were on board. They're like, okay, let's do it. We're game with that. So I still don't think they realize what it really means. You know, we haven't really started the homeschool thing yet, but they'll get into their groove. But that was my sales pitch to them. So for anyone that's tuning in, if you want to sell your kids on, you know, maybe stepping away from the norm or stepping away from a traditional school, you know, in person, maybe that's the sales pitch you give them. But
yeah. And just FaceTime, you know what I mean? Like, this is what we're talking about. Globalized world. They can talk to their friends on FaceTime. That was not like normal back in the day, right? It's
That's right. Yeah. And that's the funny thing. Like, you know, my older one, Jackson, he's like, oh, I can just FaceTime my buddy Jack or Jake. I mean, like, we just FaceTime and we can talk. And, you know, nowadays it's interesting. Like, they play video games and that's literally how they communicate now. Like, they literally talk to their friends through their video games, which was not the case when I was a kid, right? It's a different world now. And so there's much more, you know, ways to communicate in different mediums where they can stay connected, you know, than what we had when we were kids. But we should have probably covered this beginning. But ultimately, your company. Tell us a little bit more. You know, those that are tuning in, those that don't know your name, don't know your company. Tell us some more about what it is you guys do, what you specialize in, and where you focus.
Yeah, definitely. So my company is Highly Capital, which is my two kids' names put together. So Hypatia and Leonardo. But essentially, I'm in fund management. So I help retail LPs is what I call it, an individual investor like you or me, get access to institutional grade real estate deals. And, you know, my passion for starting this company was really because I almost want to be what I did not have, you know, when I was younger and I was looking for, you know, LP positions or, you know, to invest in real estate hands off. But my challenge was I didn't have access to opportunities. You know, I didn't necessarily want to just invest with my friend Joe, who down the street just decided to buy a building and was going to renovate and expecting me some like stratospheric returns. But it's like without access, like those are the kind of deals people go into and they can, you know, put their capital at higher risk than is quote unquote necessary. Like while I never promise returns to anyone, it's just like, how can I help people get access to institutional grade deals in, you know, companies like yours, Sunrise, or, you know, multifamily deals or industrial properties, just higher quality opportunities. And I help investors get access to those deals and either make cash flow from them or, you know, returns on exit once the business plan is fulfilled. But that's really what I do. So fund management, and I really love doing it. And I'm able to do it, thankfully, from here in Costa Rica.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. So, you know, being that you raise capital on behalf of other groups just like ours, Sunrise, you know, your due diligence really needs to be bulletproof, right? Like, you number one, you need to diligence the sponsor, you need to diligence the deal. Like, there's a lot of elements there. So I guess, what are the first three things that you look at when evaluating either a fund or an operator? You know, it's kind of one and the same there, but what are you looking for?
Yeah, definitely. And that is such a critical thing to highlight. And that's also what I'm very passionate about is like, how can we do better due diligence to make people make less mistakes? Like once again, never promising anything, but it's like, how can you kind of save yourself 5 years of pain potentially? And I've been in that situation personally before where I've seen deals go into litigation. So it's kind of like from pain creates, you know, more structure, more due diligence. So essentially for me, you know, obviously there's like a hard and soft aspect to it. There's kind of like the hard part where there's underwriting that needs to be reviewed. There's background checks that needs to be done on the sponsor. There's obviously like the deal documents from a deal itself, you know, anything related to the asset. So it's just getting third party underwriting reviews, all those kind of items. So that I'd call kind of like the hard component. So that is what I always provide my investors as well is like, what is all the documentation pertaining to this deal? What is the underwriting? And then as well, making sure that any questions I'm asking on my investors' behalf to the sponsor, you know, that's recorded and is available to my investors as well when I dig into the underwriting and I have that third party review it. So then there's also kind of the more like soft aspect. It's really getting to know people. You know, do you want to have dinner with them? What is their integrity like? You know, that's kind of a piece where there is a component at the end of the day that you have to trust somebody if you are going to invest in LP deals. And it's not a good fit for everyone, 1,000%. If you want a lot of control, you want to manage the property yourself, you want to get really into everything, then don't invest as an LP. And that's completely fine. But there is a component where I build a relationship with that team. And the objective on any of these deals is to work together in a long-term partnership for a long time. But then as well, there's things like the track record of performance. You know, when they have made mistakes on a deal, well, like what went wrong? How did they solve for it? So I think one of the things we've seen in the last few years, and you would know this, you know, intimately just being in the market, is just all the challenges that came up when the Feds increased interest rates. You have all these deals kind of, you know, going into distress. But some teams made it through and some didn't, right? And like, what was it about those teams that made it through? Like, what were they doing, you know, both in their investor communication, but also like on the ground and monetarily themselves to solve for the issues of the marketplace? Because there will always be issues in the marketplace, right? So there's a lot of just work that goes into supporting my investors in making, you know, hopefully better decisions in what they're deploying capital into.
Yeah, no, that's great. I mean, you bring up a great point. I mean, you know, I'm very proud to say that Sunrise, we've had on time, you know, quarterly distributions, never stopped them, even with all the craziness that's happened over the last couple of years. So it's been a beautiful thing. But, you know, but just, you know, there's obviously a lot of sponsors out there that have had some deals go sideways, some that have had many go sideways, right? But I guess those that have maybe, if someone's had a deal go sideways where they've lost money or the deal went into default, does that immediately red flag them in your mind, like as far as a potential group to invest with? Or do you dig a little deeper? Because again, just because someone had a deal go sideways doesn't necessarily mean they're a bad operator. There's a lot that are bad operators that's why it happened, but there's plenty of others that might be just got caught, you know, in the wrong part of the cycle. So just curious as to like, what are some of the red flags that really stick out to you that you're like, nope, like, I see that red flag, like that's a red flag. There's no chance. I don't have to dig any deeper. We're not going to work with that group.
Yes. And that's a great point. Like, look, like we all make mistakes. We're all human, right? I think it's just like we're playing in a bigger game when we're handling investor capital. So the biggest piece that you mentioned is, no, I would not completely write off a sponsor that's had challenges. There's just some components of, is that sponsor, you know, I'll give an example. So, you know, if there's a sponsor that, you know, did have some distress the last few years, they did have some assets go, you know, into distress, let's just call it, right? But basically from there, were they able to solve that problem? So I think that's a big piece is like, if you're getting in with a sponsor who it's their first deal, they're not well capitalized. I think that's a big piece. Like, are they well capitalized to solve that problem? And I've seen it work, right? The deals themselves were in distress, but you know, the sponsorship team, the GPs, they came in and they said, look, we're in this for the long run. We're going to support our investors through this. Yes, we may need to pause distributions. This is to make sure that the end result is better for you. Like, we're working towards that, but you know, maybe we're putting in our own money, or we're going to get, you know, some additional funding in. It's like, how did they solve for that problem? That's what I want to see, because I don't think we can completely judge on a mistake or a challenge in the marketplace, let's call it. But what was taken? What were the steps taken to improve upon that situation? And then as well, like I just personally as a selection process, I just will not work with any teams. And believe me, I get solicited all the time to work with teams. I just will not work with anybody that doesn't have some kind of developed track record, or like, no matter if they're going to offer me more money, no matter what, it's like, I just want to work with like solid, well-rounded teams, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So you mentioned as like one part of your due diligence, like you're actually doing background checks on the sponsors. I think that's great. I definitely don't think that the majority of folks probably do that, especially LPs. Like, and they wouldn't even know where to start, you know, or what they're looking for per se. And so I think one of the big areas, and would love, you know, for you to, you know, kind of share your sentiment as well, but it's just, you know, how well capitalized is the group, right? Because, you know, one thing I can promise you about any one respective deal, you know, there's a pro forma, you know, there's a business plan. And the one thing I promise you that it's never going to hit that pro forma on the mark. It's either going to exceed expectations or it's going to miss the mark, right? But it's really what happens if it misses the mark and doesn't live up to what you've projected. It's, you know, what's the staying power of the group? You know, what's their balance sheet look like? You know, how well capitalized are they? Do they have the ability financially to weather the storm? I think where a lot of LPs, I think, maybe went wrong over the last couple of years, you know, probably, you know, starting in 2020, you know, when late 2020, when interest rates dropped and, you know, everyone and their brother became a sponsor, everyone and their brother became a multifamily syndicator, is not really digging to that point right there, is understanding this person speaks a great game. You know, they can hit all the data points that really sell me on why this seems like a great opportunity. But when you go a couple layers deeper, really trying to understand, if things don't go as planned, do they have the ability financially to weather that storm? Can they support this deal? Can they help carry this through, you know, to the other side? And so would love to understand better, you know, when you're running due diligence, when you're running backgrounds and digging deep into a sponsor, what exactly are you looking for? Outside of track record's obviously important, but from a financial capability standpoint, are you digging in and asking for, you know, what's their balance sheet? You know, where's their, you know, I guess what's even the, you know, personal sponsors, like the actual GPs in the deal? Like, what are their individual balance sheets? Like, does someone have the ability to support this in the event it doesn't go as planned? Are you looking that deep into the equation?
Yeah, so definitely, you know, there's certain things that you're just not going to get an entire access to, especially once you get with a sophisticated GP who obviously has different LLCs, et cetera. But I think the biggest piece is just like at the company level as well. Like, we are focusing on, you know, the company itself. So I would say that's kind of the priority, is like, what is the balance sheet of the company? And then as well, a lot of you, as you would know, a lot of GPs are putting personal guarantees on the loans themselves. So there is some view into that. But I think there's the biggest piece is from a business. You want to look at, can the business itself, you know, support itself from its balance sheet? And it is, you know, a challenge, I think, from the last few years, but it is just something that, you know, moving forward is important for people to think about.
Has your criteria for selecting operators changed at all in the last 12 to 36 months?
Yeah, I would say like not as immediately right now. I think I always came into this industry with a little bit of like a caution. and that's just because I have been LP investing for over a decade in Canada as well as here. So I've always been a little bit more cautious. So when I came into this, you know, industry, I was more like, okay, well, I'm only going to go for, you know, what I would call like top tier operators. So definitely now though, if you want to get into kind of more of the diligence of things, you know, definitely being careful in terms of like what the capital stack looks like. So, you know, I've just seen a lot of engineering in terms of the capital stack recently, you know, adding pref equity, you know, low DSCR. So it's like now when I'm looking at a deal from a sponsor, it's like, look at the sponsor, but then as well, let's really dig into like, what does it look like in terms of the capital stack to ensure that, you know, if the capital stack has pref in it, you know, maybe that's just not a good fit ahead of my investors. But, you know, it's just, I've seen so much engineering lately. So if you want to ask what's changed, it's just like digging into a little bit more, like, what is that margin for error? Because as you said, and it's a very good thing for LPs to know, is you're not going to get a deal that hits exactly on pro forma. Like, these are all targets. And it's important to know, okay, well, if that target moves a little bit, you know, how much cushion is there in a deal to like support that movement operationally?
Have you seen any flight to more debt investments than that of equity from LPs over the last couple of years?
Yeah, I definitely have. I mean, it's interesting, like my investor base haven't been as attracted to that. I think there's still a component where, you know, LPs, for me personally, they still like to see, you know, that double digit IRR or like, you know, like high teens. And I have seen, you know, a lot of these, you know, private credit funds, et cetera, pop up. And I do think there's a good place in your, you know, your portfolio to have that. And there has been more of them. You just want to make sure that whatever you're getting into, it's not like a capital call in disguise, right? So that's kind of the challenge as well, is like when you have a pref equity fund, it's like, okay, well, is it rescue capital or is it actually, you know, something that is just more of a loan where you're in a better position on an asset that's doing well? So the marketplace has changed. But then as well, investors still want what investors want. So it really just depends on kind of helping them and guiding them so that they have a diversified portfolio, which is personally my priority, even under the umbrella of commercial real estate, which, as you know, is vast, right? There's lots of different things here.
If you would unpack that, you made a comment about rescue capital being disguised as a credit fund or a debt investment. Unpack what you mean by that, because I know what you mean. I've seen a lot of it, but would love for you to elaborate if you would.
Yeah. So I think like this, and look, I'm not going to make right or wrong in the statement that I'm making. It's just that, for example, a team that maybe like had some assets at issue, right? So there were some challenges in some of the assets. So obviously, instead of saying, you know, we're going to give them to the bank and it's all done, you create like a fund where it kind of like rescues those deals by taking like more investor capital in, if that's a little bit more of a clean way to describe it. But that's not kind of shared with the investors going into that fund, that they're actually just rescuing deals that are in distress. Instead, they just think that they're in a better position or they're in a preferred position and have more security to their investment. So it's just making sure, once again, to unpack it a little bit further and not making it right or wrong, but it's just understanding that, you know, you can blanket something with one term, and it's just making sure you know how the underlying assets are performing themselves.
Yep. No, I agree. And we've seen a lot of that out there. It doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but you need to understand exactly, you know, what that debt fund, what it's investing in, right? Like, you need to ask a lot more questions. You speak to a lot of LPs. Do you see that their concerns today differ from that of what their concerns might have been, you know, 3 or 4 years ago?
Yeah. So I think when you say concerns, there's a lot of just like caution in the marketplace now in general. I'm sure you understand that too, although you guys are doing very well. So I don't know, you've already built up enough of an engine to kind of like maybe, you know, get through the less capital that's coming into the marketplace currently because of the fear and the caution where people lost money. And obviously they're going to wait and see what happens with the market. I think there's just more caution overall. And I do not think it's a bad thing. Like, really, when it comes down to it, you know, everybody's hard-earned money is going into these LP deals. And to kind of see things go a little bit sideways has LPs ask better questions. And also has them request a little bit more. And I personally am a big believer in that. I love when my investors come to me and they want to understand things better. I love educating people. That's maybe partially why I enjoy this so much. But it's really just there's more caution and they're asking more questions about like the security of what the deal is. They're more aware that there has been challenges in the real estate marketplace. But I think at the end of the day, though, people still go into these real estate syndications because they have a higher target IRR that they may be making in like the stock market, right? So it's a little bit of a balance of hitting the targets, but also, you know, showing a little bit more risk mitigation in how the deal is structured.
What do you find to be, do you find that IRR is the most important metric that your, you know, typical LP is looking at?
I would say so. It's kind of just something that is easily understood in a sense. And I find as well, you know, there's still a portion of this where when you're getting into, you know, a hands-off real estate deal, there's still kind of, you see something and you want that thing, right? So I find that there's just some target numbers that LPs can kind of look at a deal by deal and they use as a comparison metric. But the thing is, like, there's different needs that every LP has. And that's kind of what I dig into with my LPs. And that's why people invest with you. Like, there's a specific need that they have that has them invest in that asset class, right? But I find, you know, it's really important for them to know, do they want more cash flow now or do they want, you know, a higher return later? You know, you have to look at the equity multiple as well. So there's a few benchmarks, but I'd say over a 2x equity multiple, I find is something that a lot of investors are kind of looking for, at least my investors.
I'm not the first point of contact to a lot of new LPs coming into the fray, but we spend quite a bit of time for our investor relations team and really try to unpack, you know, what's happening. You know, what conversations are they having today compared to what it looks like, you know, looked like a couple of years back on a marketing deck, on a pitch deck. You know, IRR always stands out and people start making comparisons of like, well, this one's better because the projected IRR is 18 instead of this one over here being 14. But there's also, you know, the risk adjusted return aspect of it. You know, is it a value add deal? Is it heavy turnaround? Is it a core plus or core asset? Like, is it already cash flowing today? You know, like, what has to happen in order for me to actually achieve that end metric, that target metric there? And so I personally found that that's there's still quite a bit of confusion around that, whether that's good or bad. So I guess the advice I would give for anyone that's tuning, if you're an LP, whether you're just getting started or you know, maybe you've made a number of investments, is to really understand what metrics are important to you and why, and be able to unpack and actually explain what each one of those means. And in the event that that metric doesn't come true, what does that look like for your investment that you made into the deal? And so, you know, I will tell you that I've got quite a bit of capital in various LP investments and across the wide variety of asset classes, a wide variety of sponsors, some that were a little newer to the game, most that had been in it for many, many years. But each one I've made that investment for different reasons. Some is truly IRR driven. And it's just a literally get in, you know, get in, turn it around, get out, and really shooting for a high return. But it's a short fuse type, you know, deal. And then there's other ones that are cash flowing that, as we know, as time goes on, IRR gets driven down. And so it's not an IRR deal. Like, this is more of a cash flow play. This is more of a core plus type asset. And they intend to hold it 5-7 years. And while it might only, you know, kick off 5 or 6%, you know, returns on an annualized basis, like, I know that it's consistent, steady income. We don't have to shoot for the moon on it, and it's fine. So having a blend of all those things together, really understanding, you know, your own investment goals and be able to actually pick and choose the investments that best help you get you to the finish line, and not just being solely focused on that IRR metric, which, again, you know, it's kind of a pie in the sky number. It is, you know, as we do this for a longer time, you know, longer periods of time, we all get better at, you know, running projections. But as we talked about earlier, you know, a projection is just that, it's projection. It definitely isn't a true indicator of what's really going to happen at deal. And hopefully you do better, but a lot of times you miss the mark, right? And hopefully it all kinds of averages out in the long run. You know, you've talked about working, you know, with your family as a child, you're basically doing cleanouts of units, which is, I can't think of one thing that would help turn someone off from wanting to get into real estate than actually having to do a turn after a tenant moves out. I mean, for those, again, that are listening here, if you've never actually had rental properties, and some rental properties, but if you got A-class stuff, then hopefully you've got tenants that got 700 plus credit scores and they actually care about the credit and they're going to, you know, sweep it clean and make it nice and there's not holes in the walls. But then you got the other end of the spectrum, right? You go and there's this, like, literally their entire belongings that they've owned, all the dirty, you know, the dirty couches, you know, the sinks overflowing, the toilets are disgusting. It's nasty, right? Probably bugs and all that stuff. That would vary. If I would have to say that if I was a young child and I saw that, like, if my parents were not in real estate, I kind of got into it, you know, as an adult. But if I would have seen that as a young child, you know, cockroaches crawling around and all that gross stuff that comes with it, I probably would have chosen a different career path. And so, that's where you got your start. I guess, curious to know some of those earlier experiences that you had, helping your parents clean the rentals, helping with the books, doing all these things. Like, what carried forward from those experiences that you now have parlayed into Highly Capital? Like, you know, what are those things that now you basically bring as value to Highly Capital?
I didn't like it as a kid. So it's not like this is some romanticized notion that I was like enjoying the work. Like, I hated it. And my dad was like Croatian. He was like, you must work all the time. Like, he just would drive me. I did not like it. But this is the thing. We have kids now, right? And it's like, you just look at everything differently as you get older. So when I was a kid, I did not like it. I just remember all those like millipedes crawling around when I'd be mopping around. Like, it was just disgusting. But the biggest thing, and I think this is the distinction, is I also got to spend in the summer 2 months in Croatia with my dad. And I think that that was really the shift when I saw how hard he worked for 10 months of the year, literally two jobs, working all the time. But then we went to Croatia in the summer and got to go to the beach. And, you know, he had rental income coming from his properties. It's like something about that experience made it click for me. And I give him so much credit to that, that it really just really changed my perception about like work hard, play hard. But it really helped me understand, you know, that when you work hard, and that's what I bring to Highly Capital, like I really, really care about, you know, helping my investors get access to these deals, but showing that, you know, if you work hard, there will be fruits to your labor. And I think just having that, like, you know, that kind of glimpse when I was a child really helped me to see, you know, what the potential of real estate is, and what had me, I guess, maybe, I don't know if he'd be happy about that. He's no longer here, but he wanted me to be a doctor. I didn't end up being a doctor, but really showed me, you know, like, this is now what you can achieve when you really, you know, put your head down, work hard, and also see kind of what you can do in terms of enjoying life.
I think that's a typical immigrant story. My wife immigrated here from Poland when she was 10. And so I've had obviously many conversations with her parents. They came here really with the intent of staying for a year to have my wife and her slightly older brother just basically learn English, right? And you know, kind of test the American schools out for a year, but then go back. Their intent was always to go back, but they ultimately stayed. You know, it's interesting, you know, just their work ethic. They came here, you know, they were highly educated. They were both computer engineers and came here and literally had to take steps back. Her dad worked at a library, and her mom had like an admin job, you know, and just kind of just grinded it out and just worked really hard and didn't really have anything handed to them. But, you know, that work ethic, it's interesting. I did not come from at somewhere down my lineage that someone was an immigrant, but like not firsthand experience, right? But it's interesting watching, you know, just getting to know her family, her mom and dad over the last couple of decades, and just their work ethic, what they've done. They built a rental portfolio, just never had anything handed to them, built it all from scratch. And what I've learned from that, and it's played out on numerous occasions of other really successful folks that I've spoken with over the years, that whether immigrant or not, is that you're almost guaranteed to win or find your way to the top 5%, probably to the 1%, if you just work harder than the next people, you know, to the people to your side. I mean, like to anyone else around you, if you just work a little harder. And there's a point in time where, like, hopefully all that work does pay off, where you don't necessarily have to grind, you know, 80 hours, 90 hours a week. But if you just work harder, put a little bit more in, put a little more effort in, learn a little bit more, read another book, you know, instead of watching TV, read books, right? You know, go to real estate meetup groups, whatever you need to do, just do a little bit more than the next person in line. And more than likely, you're going to find success at some point down the road. And it's like, it's almost a given. It's like her parents, probably just like your dad, like, I don't know, they bought rental property and they probably bought it cash because there probably was no financing back then, right? Like they just scrounged all their money and like saved, bought rental property because they knew it was going to be a long-term, you know, good play, a good investment. It's going to serve them well. It's going to serve you guys well. But they had to make sacrifices in order to buy that, right? They could have probably gone on vacation, could have probably bought a car, but they worked their asses off to kind of plant those early seeds. And so it's just, I think it's an important lesson for anyone that might be tuning in here that's just kind of getting rolling in real estate, is that number one, it's not get rich quick. I mean, you're going to have pops, you're going to do deals. If you're in it long enough, you're going to do a couple of deals where you just knock it out of the park, right? But most of the time they're singles and doubles, right? And it just time stacks upon, you know, the years over, you know, over many, many years, it just continues compounding, building up. But it's a long game. And so, you know, essentially you also mentioned your dad always thought that, you know, he might be disappointed now, but he always thought you were going to be a doctor or whatever. I think that's also part of the immigrant story. You need to be a doctor, lawyer, or engineer, right? Is that the three? Doctor, lawyer, engineer. That's it. Like those are the professions you need to go with. And that's funny. My wife was actually, my wife's brother or my brother-in-law, he's a doctor. My wife decided to go the other route. She went into finance and her parents were very disappointed, but she did it because it was the most money she could make getting out of college. And, but it's interesting. Like they gave her crap about it for many years. I understand after she graduated college that she didn't go to medical school or, you know, go to be an engineer or go to be a lawyer or what have you. But I think that's the typical immigrant. So it's what the best for you, right? They want you to do well, you know, basically have a life that maybe they didn't have or have the opportunity to have. But so we'd love to know, Haile Capital, what are you most excited about here over the next couple of years? Like, what are you most excited about? Where do you see the opportunities? Where do they lie? And this is a multi-pronged question. And I think the last component of it is, asset classes that you're most excited about and where are you spending your time, energy, and efforts?
So I'm very excited for this year. I think, as you know, it's been a tough couple of years just in terms of like just overall the sentiment, right? But it's just watching the sentiment shift, and it's going to happen again. But we're really in this like really great time in the marketplace where there's been bad sentiment. So prices were low and now, you know, and money's on the sidelines. But this year I find, you know, the biggest piece is educating my investors, and my priority is getting them into different asset classes because, you know, as we know and we've experienced, it's like you don't want to be tied. It, like, kind of tying to your last point, look, like there's no secret out there, right? There's no kind of like magic pill. There's no, in my opinion, like maybe I'm wrong, but when you mention, for example, like you just work hard and work harder than the next person, it sounds kind of boring, but like that kind of just what it is. Like, I think it was Alex Hormozi who said it's basically, you got to get past boring. That's how you get successful. It's like you got to go through boring, and that's really how you get to the other side. So I think the biggest thing for my investors now is, you know, I want to make sure that they're diversified into different asset classes, but also understanding that like there's the fundamentals of why you get into it in the first place, right? And it's, for example, multifamily, it's because, you know, we just know that there's a housing need, but there's some things that investors are looking for as well right now in my world, and they're looking for more cash flow. And that's partially because a lot of my investors are either people who've exited businesses or ones who are planning, you know, they're very successful in their careers and they're looking to, you know, move on from that corporate lifestyle and they want to create some of those income streams. So I've seen a bit of a shift to more cash flowing investments. So for me personally, you know, partnering with Sunrise is on my list this year. And essentially it's because I am having more interest in like the mobile home park space, in addition to triple net. So that's being something triple net leases where there's a consistency of cash flow from like a sale lease back. That's also something that I've made available to my investors this year as well. So my priority is just helping them get into different asset classes. As you mentioned in your portfolio, is to have different investments for different reasons and not being too tied to one thing or one operator. And for example, this year, like I said, it would be the triple net. Very excited about mobile homes. Still doing like multifamily as my foundation because that's what I grew up in. That's what I still truly believe in, like long term. But just allowing investors to do that. And then as well, getting in different portions of the capital stack. So for example, that private credit fund, for example, I do have an offering like that for my investors. But it's just kind of, you know, working with what they're looking for. And then on my end, doing the due diligence to find the best partner for that thing that they're looking for.
That's great. I guess, you know, as far as multifamily being the, you kind of like your basis, what are you seeing? I mean, what's state of the union of multifamily right now? Surely there was some pain that's played out, but I guess, are there a lot of opportunities that you're seeing? Some good, you know, not necessarily, a lot of the deals that they're not necessarily distressed deals. They're most of the time distressed partnerships or structures that the, you know, that the sponsorship group had. But what are you seeing, you know, out in your world looking for deals, looking at different sponsors that are in the multifamily space? Are there a lot of deals coming to the fray?
Yeah, I mean, there's more now. I think because there's just more alignment between like sellers and buyers. And essentially there's like, you know, it just naturally happens. There's a lifespan to the deal. Like maybe it's a PE firm, they need to exit, like whatever it is. They need to, their 5 years is up. They need to go out. Maybe it's not the best market to sell. It's kind of the same in residential and commercial, right? Maybe it's not the best market to sell in, but you have to sell. So you're not going to get the price that you wanted a couple of years ago. So, you know, we are seeing deals, not like to your point, they're not always distressed, like terribly, you know, like foreclosure distressed, but there's something about it that they have to sell. They're not going to get the price that they got a couple of years ago. So it is, you know, creating an opportunity to go in and negotiate a little bit better. But I would say right now we're just seeing deal flow increase a little bit more. Like it was definitely slower the last few years, at least on my end. So things are just picking up. You know, I don't want to ever say I have a crystal ball and I have the answer for everything. But it's like once there's proof of concept that things are improving, whether that's like interest rates or what have you, you just naturally see more action in the market, as you would probably understand in your asset class as well. But that's what we're seeing in multifamily. It's just like more deal flow, still good opportunities, but you just had to sift through more to find them.
Have you found an opportunity in investing abroad? I mean, basically in Costa Rica where you're at now, I mean, you know the lay of the land, you know the marketplace. Is there an opportunity to actually diversify there as well?
Yeah, so there's definitely tons of opportunity in Costa Rica. I personally, just from like, I've personally invested, like I lived in a couple of countries. I lived in Belize, I lived in Argentina, I lived in Florida for a bit too, in Fort Lauderdale. But, you know, I also invested in, you know, deals in like Belize, for example. And I think the challenge with investing abroad, and this is my opinion, like, so don't take it as the truth, but it's like, you just have to know, like, you're getting into a whole different game. You do not know the political climate. You do not know the laws. You don't know the regulations. Or I'm not saying you don't, I don't. And I'm not going to bring my investors into a deal where like, I don't know the lay of the land. So definitely in my community, in where I live in Nosara, there's a lot of hotels being built. There's probably investments. I know people that are developing, but it's like, unless I know for not, I don't want to say anything's 100%, but at least if, unless I know that they really understand that market, I've firsthand seen the challenges of like trying to develop, for example, in a different country. And I'm personally just not, it's not something I want to pursue at this moment in time. I don't know if that answers it, but it's a different game, right?
I think you can't comfortably explain the nuance associated with a different investment type or in a different country, then like, yeah, stay away. Right? I feel the same way. So, I mean, I'm kind of on the same page as you. I personally believe there's enough opportunity in the U.S. To do what we do and to make great returns, to buy great investments in great markets that will have a lot of growth potential, and to not necessarily have to span outside and go, you know, abroad and go to an area that's completely unknown to me that I've got to learn from scratch. So I'm on the same page, agree with you. Obviously, there's a lot of folks that have done quite well. Lots of other syndicators out there that are raising capital for projects that are in various different countries. But again, I think there's enough opportunity here. I firmly believe that, you know, we don't necessarily have to start looking elsewhere. Well, Sarah, this has been a fun conversation. I really appreciate you coming on the show and just, you know, being open about your journey and, you know, the approach you guys take there, Highly Capital, to due diligence. And it's just really cool to see that you've built a pretty awesome business that supports the lifestyle for you and your family. It's just, it's a beautiful thing. You know, for those that want to learn more, that want to, you know, learn more about you, Highly, you know, the different opportunities that you have available, where's the best place to track you down?
Yeah, for sure. So, I mean, like, most of my investors come through referrals, but I am also very active on LinkedIn. So if you go on LinkedIn, Sarah with an H, and then Miss Kelly, MISKELLY, find me on LinkedIn, come say hello. I'm always posting about, you know, my experiences in real estate, trying to give education and advice. I'm very passionate about it. And so I'd say that's the best place to find me. Otherwise, you can just go to my website, which is highlycapital.com.
Good deal. Awesome, Sarah. Thanks for coming to the show. And guys, we'll put all that stuff in the show notes as well. And to everyone listening, appreciate that you came here today. And if you enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to the show, leave a rating and review. Helps us continue attracting amazing guests like Sarah here to the show and keeps the podcast growing. So until next week's show, wishing you really strong deals and even stronger cash flow. You take care. We'll see you next week.